Hi, everyone. We'd like to get started, please. We've got a lot to talk about today. So first and foremost, thank you all for coming here today. My name is Christy Pekikero. I am an assistant professor of early modern French studies at George Mason University in Northern Virginia. And I'm honored to be chairing this plenary roundtable addressing structural racism in French history and French historical studies. I want to open up the roundtable by saying a few words about exciting new developments in the Western Society for French History and about the roundtable's theme of structural racism. Given the current political climate and ongoing discussions regarding diversity and inclusion on college campuses and in academia more broadly, the Western Society for French History has committed to a program of institutional innovations in order to continue the long-standing tradition of the Western as a place of inclusiveness. Over the past 2 years, the Society's executive officers and governing council have been pursuing this issue, establishing two committees, one of which I was privileged to be chair, and subsequently pioneering a number of exciting features that are being inaugurated at this conference: a new mission statement that you can soon read on the website, a mentoring program, and this event, the Western Society for French History Conference, Plenary Roundtable, and Workshop Series. The plenary roundtable focuses on an important topic in the profession, with some attention to equity, diversity, and inclusion, and is coupled with a workshop that focuses on pedagogical and methodological issues related to the roundtable theme. The workshop, which takes place this afternoon, gives conference participants the chance to delve deeper into theoretical questions, into methodologies and sources, curriculum development, classroom management, professional situations, and more. These new elements of the annual conference and of the society more generally are a part of a concerted effort to inform and empower each member of our community to thrive in the profession and to be proactive participants in achieving equity and inclusion in the production and transmission of knowledge about the Francophone world. I want to begin with a round of applause for the Society's leadership, for its commitment to piloting this important programming, to the committees that have contributed to this effort, and to the panelists for coming to share their perspectives on today's theme of structural racism. What is structural racism? Structural racism is the system in which public policies, institutional practices, cultural representations, and other norms work in various, often mutually reinforcing ways to perpetuate racial group inequity. It is the normalization and legitimization of an array of dynamics, historical, cultural, institutional, and interpersonal, that in the French and American contexts routinely advantage white people while producing cumulative and chronic adverse outcomes for people of color. It is a system of hierarchy and inequity, primarily characterized by white supremacy, the preferential treatment, privilege, and power for white people at the expense of a long list of racially oppressed people, including individuals of North African, Sub-Saharan African, East Asian, South Asian, and Middle Eastern descents, among many others. Structural racism is often called the silent opportunity killer. It is the most profound, pervasive, and pernicious form of racism, from which all other forms of racism emerge. It encompasses a vast system of racial supremacy that is diffused and infused in all aspects of society, including our history, culture, politics, economics, and our entire social fabric. We are all a part of this system, even if it is despite ourselves. French history and our contemporary moment present numerous examples of structural racism, from the Code Noir and the policing of race, including blacks and Jews in the metropole during the Ancien Régime, to the theories and mechanisms of colonialism in the 19th century, through the modern period, in which processes of decolonization, urban planning, policies concerning labor, military deployments, education, and laïcité, the arts, and of course the French political landscape, which has seen a shocking rise of the extreme right in the form of Marine Le Pen and Le Front National. And as we heard yesterday in Tyler's presentation and the discussion afterward, structural racism is part of a much more complex system of different types of discrimination, gender, sexuality, religion, and others, whose combinations and cumulative effects or intersectionality necessitate analysis and activism. This holds true in the United States and in academia as well, as these dynamics play out in professional trajectories, in the world of academic publishing, in our universities, and in our classrooms. There is no better time for us to interrogate these structures, to build our understanding, and ultimately combine our strength to affect change. Today's roundtable will offer a number of perspectives and pathways to inform us and to empower us to engage in courageous conversations about structural racism. These interventions are brief and are meant to open up discussion that will continue in the Q&A, in the workshop after lunch, and hopefully beyond that. In the program, the speakers are listed in alphabetical order, but we have reordered things a bit. So we will be beginning today with Jennifer Boitin. Jennifer Anne Boitin is Associate Professor of French, Francophone Studies and History at the Pennsylvania State University. Her first book, Colonial Metropolis, The Urban Grounds of Anti-Imperialism and Feminism in Interwar Paris, Nebraska, 2010, out in paperback in 2015, explores the connection between West African, Malagasy, and Antillean men and women, and their French feminist counterparts in Paris during the 1920s and 30s. She has published articles in Gender and History, French Politics, Culture and Society, Historical Reflections, Réflexions Historiques, and French Colonial History, and has co-edited a volume of French historical studies exploring the question of who is French. In summer 2015, she published an article in Signs entitled, Are You Trying to Play a French Woman? La Mère Patrie and the Female Body in French West Africa, which is an early iteration of her new book, on privacy, gender, Frenchness, and mobility in French West Africa and French Indochina during the early 20th century. She also sees as a part of her trajectory the fact that she has been lucky enough to work with a number of bright and innovative PhD students over the years, several of whom she has talked into attending this very conference. So you are welcome. Today she will speak to us about studying the categories of race and gender, both from within France and from outside. Jennifer.
I was just wondering if I should stand, but apparently sitting is what we're going to do. It's all right. Well, I can go. All right. So, a little under a year ago, I was presenting at another conference, which Tyler also attended, and in fact, somewhat helped to organize, and he was a plenary speaker there as well, titled Quel citoyen pour l'Empire, which was hosted by Paris 8, which some in this room no doubt already know as one of the more radical campuses in the Paris region. Also one of the few to have a gender studies program and to deal very openly with the question of race, and especially blacks in France, via a long-standing seminar on the question. So given that particular context, I was a bit surprised when one of the scholars in the room at the end of my presentation, which I gave in French because I was in France and also because I am French, he prefaced his question with a sort of throwaway comment. Bon, déjà, je pense qu'il ne faut pas utiliser le mot race dans la langue française. I wish he meant this statement in a utopian way, but what he meant was, it's an American problem and has no place here. A bit later, another scholar's question to our panel, this time from a woman, started like this. Pour moi, le genre ne sert strictement à rien. Ceux qui veulent parler de ces choses-là ont déjà le féminisme après tout. So apparently I give provocative talks. Apologies in advance. For now, I just want to focus on this idea that the word race is not French because it leads us to another important question. How do you study something when the word most recognized to describe it is not accepted as having its place in the French language by some people? How do you think through sociocultural inequality and structural racism if race itself is not a French category? So on the day of the conference, I had an easy answer because it turns out I wrote my first book in part on the word race. And in it, I think through how the word was used and explained by the black men and women who lived in Paris during the interwar years. Some were certainly bilingual or trilingual, but all were also native-born French speakers, and most were also French citizens, and many were highly educated. So if you're saying that you can't use the word race in French, then you're saying that a black French citizen with degrees from the Sorbonne or Normale Sup or Henri IV can't speak proper French. You're saying that when the Martinican author Colette Nardal published her article titled Éveil de la conscience de race, she did not mean race as color. But of course she did when she wrote, and I quote her, Les femmes de couleur, vivant seules dans la métropole, moins favorisées jusqu'à l'exposition coloniale que leurs congénères masculins au facile succès, ont ressenti bien avant eux le besoin d'une solidarité raciale. C'est ainsi qu'elles se sont éveillées à la conscience de race. So my answer on the day of the conference was relatively easy, because I study people who discuss race. But I left and started informally asking French colleagues of mine who study aspects of race in France, because they are there, via themes such as nationality, citizenship, African-American literature, structural racism in the justice system, including the treatment of racist slurs by the police in the justice system, what they thought of my experience, of this experience I'd had during the conference. So no one was surprised, first of all. But we debated the relationship between refusing the word race and addressing the problem of racism, including structural racism, within the academy itself in France. Several of my colleagues with origins outside of the metropole, including in North Africa, Mauritius Island, Guadeloupe, Martinique, Haiti, Guyane, and Corsica, and there is a logic there, proposed that the structuralism of this racism was partly about the refusal to recognize the fact that in France, we do, in fact, have an American-style history of using the word race to denote color, which does not mean it's an identical process, but it certainly has significant and important resemblances, most of my colleagues agreed. Race is color, such as the preferred self-denomination among some men and women of black, said in French today to describe themselves, is not a recent American import. For example, in research for my current book, I uncovered a significant number of documents produced by administrators who forgot to use the code words of European to signal white and African to signify black, and instead defaulted immediately to color as a descriptor. This is in the 20s and 30s. So today's refusal to accept that race is French erases the manners in which race is color, and hence racism, informed by different physical traits, has been one part of French history for centuries. The second problem, most identified among my colleagues, was within the academy itself in France. Several of my colleagues stated they experienced more racism. Now, this is informal conversations, but still, it was a repeated theme, that they experienced more racism, especially backhanded microaggressions, within their academic structures than out on the streets. All pointed out that with few exceptions, and Pepin Diaye at Sciences Po is one of these, most professors are not hired because they study racial questions or have already published on questions of race. They only manage to do so indirectly or after their first book, usually. And so the academy itself is structured to refuse race, since it self-replicates when a professor retires, he or she is replaced by someone in that same field. Which is why many people who study the question, even people such as Pepin Diaye, spend time outside the French Academy or outside the metropole for their studies. And many actually come to the United States, including some of my students over the years. So to return to my question of what to do about structural racism when the word race itself is not recognized as French, let alone as a real signifier of sociocultural inequality and profoundly inequitable power structures, one of my answers is keep studying the word itself throughout history. For example, keep thinking about how people who are not the white metropolitan majority at any point in history use the word race. What does it mean to them? What does it allow them to achieve? How does tracing the history of such a word and its color-based co-signifiers help us to identify structural racism throughout history, and ideally also help us to explain it to others on all sides of the Atlantic and across the world? Stop.
Next, we will hear from Miriam Halle-Davis, who is an assistant professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Her current book project studies how the post-war reinvention of a market economy influenced prevailing ideas of race and national identity in Algeria. She has published articles in the Journal of Contemporary History, the Journal of European Integration History, the Journal of French and Francophone Philosophy, and Middle East Critique. She is the co-editor of a volume entitled North Africa and the Making of Europe, Institutions, Governance, and Culture, which will be published in February 2018. Today she will speak to us about whether Islam constitutes a racial category. Miriam.
Hi. I want to echo everybody's sentiment thanking the organizers for this panel and the series of panels. It's wonderful to be here and have these conversations. This is the second time I've participated in one of these kind of altered format panels, and I take it as an invitation to a rant. So that is my declared objective here, but in 7 minutes, that's more or less what you're going to get. So just think that there's a very interesting and well-supported footnote underneath every polemical statement I make. So I was very happy to be invited to this panel also because I thought racism is by definition structural racism, right? There is no racism that's not structural. And at the same time, I felt this is a very important issue to be brought up and fleshed out precisely for the reasons that Jennifer brought out. Why is it so, why does it feel so gutsy to talk about structural racism when all racism is structural? And I do think that this switch in vocabulary actually opens up a lot of doors, both in the political work that some of us do, and I'm not the only one here who's had the honor of being called an Islamo-gauchiste in the French media, but also in terms of historiographical questions that some of us are dealing with. I work on Algeria, so of course I have Fanon in the back of my head at all times, and some of my reflections you'll see kind of are coming out of reading him and Dabashi's reading of Fanon in Brown Skin, White Masks. So first of all, I think that kind of decentering the vocabulary and thinking about race both as an actor's category, as we just heard, but also as an analytic category is helpful here. One of the books that was formative for me was the volume on racial formation in the U.S. by Omi and Winant. And so I wanted to know, what would this bring a study of Islamophobia, the word Islamophobia itself? What kind of work does that do? And then I'm going to just extend this forward to the discussions on Islamo-gauchisme. What does that mean? What is that? And can we, is it responsible, you know, pedagogically we often tell our students colonial echoes matter and they matter today, and it's a very effective way of getting students engaged. But is this kind of straight line from 1962 to 2017 doing us a disservice? And that's the rant. So, does the term Islamophobia do the work we need to do? As Fanon reminds us, French settlers are not Islamophobic, right? They're invested in building a nation on the economic and social resources of whiteness. It's not the same thing. Similarly, in a ranty mode, the notion that Muslims in Algeria or elsewhere are merely racialized or others, I find maddeningly imprecise. One has the idea that racialization falls from the sky, it just happens, or that there are populations that were not racialized, i.e. The white settler population in Algeria, which, as we know, there's a lot of work that is done in making these populations white, either through naturalization, with the Crimea Decree, or in taking a ragtag population of southern Italians and Maltese and making them white. So whiteness itself is a category that we need to interrogate. And also, just as a kind of a footnote, right, there's no conversion for the Algerian Muslim. That's not possible. They become a Musulman Catholique, and the entire naturalization is premised on their Islamic beliefs being a foreclosure to citizenship. So those are kind of the historical footnotes that I would have developed. And so a definition of racial formation, on the other hand, denotes, and I'm quoting the Omi and Winant here, the socio-historical process by which racial categories are created, inhabited, transformed, and destroyed. And I'll come back to the transformed part in the second part of my 7 minutes. And so this incentive to use a religious rather than racial lens is not a new phenomenon. And one sees it in the most used currents of post-colonial thought. I mean, Jacques Derrida, Abrahamic religions, this is a vocabulary we know well, or even in some of the newer works on decoloniality, Walter Mignolo, etc. And this places the discussion on grounds of tolerance, of orthodoxy, and takes us away from the questions of racial formation and structural racism that we're here to discuss. So I actually find the term anti-Muslim racism more useful. And the question of, is France's post-2006 life related to colonization, I'd like to say yes or no. And here I come back to the way that racial categories are transformed. So the notion of Islamo-gauchisme has become very, unfortunately, common in France, and attacking academics and mediatic figures as Islamo-gauchiste. And for these people writing, those of us who've been accused of being Islamo-gauchistes, we are apologists for the damnés de la terre, right? So they're actually using a Fanonian word and saying the problem with these people is that they want to see these people as eternal victims, these people being Muslims and often Palestinians in particular. But I would argue that Islamo-gauchism as a category only makes sense once a certain liberal stance regarding Islam has been accepted, and once a certain vision of what the left is, or gauchism is, has also been accepted. And here, if I had another 20 minutes, I would argue that the Algerian Civil War is actually the place that we need to go to think about this, right? So the Algerian Civil War being the moment where you have a split between radicateur and réconciliateur, and also the transformation of Algeria as a place that used to be a model for socialism and third worldism that becomes reinscribed as a place of radical Islamism. And I would also note that Algerian intellectuals themselves and the migration of Algerian intellectuals from Algeria to France, one can think of people like Malik Benabi, Boualem Sansal, more in a more contemporary vein, Kamal Daoud, but I will definitely not be speaking on that. So I just wanted to show you one image I came across while preparing this talk that I had seen, that a friend had sent me. Islamo-gauchism, what is it? This comes from, ta-da, the blackness. This is good, it adds to suspense. All part of the plan. So this is from the pages of Le Figaro magazine, l'Islamosphère. Right, and you have this coterie of politicians, right? You have Hamon, Poutou, Tariq Ramadan, Adol Pinel, etc., who are there, and the idea, we've seen images like this before, right? Partisans of a religion who are conspiring to take over the world. This should raise very worrying imagery. And I would also note that only two of the people on this kind of conspiracy theory geography self-identify as Muslims, right? So Islamo-gauchism as a racial category, I would just kind of index the fact that if we take seriously that race is, right, the biological as a placeholder and that it's a matrix of cultural and biological elements, that also means that contamination is a threat, right? People who work on urban history or disease know this. There's always the contamination of the racial. And here one sees the contamination, right, of the racial as a political threat to France. And so I just wanted to end actually with some words from Sartre, an anti-Semite and Jew, because I think this ties in very well. He says, "If I wish to know who the Jew is, I must first inquire into the situation surrounding him, since he is a being in a situation." So to me, the call to structural racism is to go back to the situation, and also to suggest that the situation is not reducible to a phobia. Thanks.
Thank you, Mariam. Next is Manayo Nasiali. She is an assistant professor of history at UCLA. She has published a number of articles that have appeared in the American Historical Review and the Journal of Urban History. Her book, Native to the Republic, Empire, Social Citizenship, and Everyday Life in Marseille since 1945, was published by Cornell University Press in 2016. Today she will speak to us about her experiences working with members of Marseille's Comorian community and navigating how the personal and community archives that they shared shaped her research in state-run archives. Manayo.
All right, well, thank you, everyone. This is a real privilege to be part of this panel. Thank you, Christy, for organizing. I'm going to kind of share in a kind of more informal way a number of anecdotes and experiences that have really made me think very carefully about race as a category of analysis, but also about the archives and the production of knowledge in the academy. And the first story I want to share is a very sad story, actually. I want to talk about the murder of a young French Comorian boy named Ibrahim Ali Abdallah, who was murdered by the National Front in 1995. And this kind of tragic story forms the kind of centerpiece of the final chapter in my book. So on the night that Ibrahim was killed, he had finished up a rehearsal in a state-run youth center in Marseille. Ibrahim lived in La Savine, which is one of from one of Marseille's northern neighborhoods. And Ibrahim was part of this kind of informal hip-hop group called Buvai. So he and his friends had wrapped up this rehearsal quite late, and afraid they'd miss the last bus home, they began running towards the bus stop. It was also Ramadan, and so they were eager to get home to be with their families. Unbeknownst to them, next to the bus stop was this car. And in the car were three members of the FN who had been patrolling the neighborhood, protecting the neighborhood, right? And they were armed. And when these three men saw these three dark figures running towards them, they reacted. One of the men gets out of the car. He was trained as a master marksman, basically had sniper training, and he opens fire. He begins shooting at these boys. The boys, realizing that they're being shot at, they turn on the heels. They begin running back to the youth center, but for Ibrahim, it was too late. He was shot in the back, and he died there in the street. There's, of course, much more to this story that I don't have time to talk about now, but as in kind of aftermath of this murder, the FN members said that they had acted in self-defense, that this was the reason for why they had shot and killed Ibrahim. So over the course of researching this this very tragic story, I came across an interview that was recorded about 10 years after Ibrahim was killed. And it was recorded for a website run by members of Marseille's very large Comorian community. And one of Ibrahim's friends who had survived the attack tells the interviewer kind of point blank, and here's the direct quote. He tells the interviewer, "Ibrahim was killed because he was black." I remember when I read this, I was really kind of struck, taken aback, both because of the way he said it, the kind of the pain, the trauma still evident in his voice, but also because I was thinking, how am I going to reconcile this statement with the scholarship and the way with the scholarship and the way the French Academy in particular has tried to deal with questions, or not deal with questions of race. So I want to share now another experience. So just the other day, I was doing a book talk, and as part of the event, a number of critics were there giving feedback on my book, which was wonderful. And one of the scholars was a French scholar, and here there are going to be echoes with Jennifer's talk. One of the scholars says, you know what, I think this book would really be great, especially if it was written, about kind of the African-American experience in the United States. Specifically, I know we're laughing, but I think this is, she took issue with the critical methodology that I employed in the book, specifically the ways in which I talked about race as a category of analysis, and she said, you know what, this really, just, there is no place for a discussion about race. The French academic community, I shouldn't say community, the French Academy, will not be able to resonate, will not be able to really kind of engage with the book. So I want to return to this statement, Ibrahim died because he was black. And I want to think about it in relationship to this comment. So, of course, there are many in France now, specifically at Paris 8, right? Many scholars who are, of course, engaging with notions of race and are doing so very much in the, doing so, I think, very much in a way that engages, for example, with Stuart Hall, Paul Gilroy, thinking about race as an articulation. And are doing so in a way that I think engages with some of the anxiety that this French scholar had. Specifically, they're not talking about race as a kind of biological essentialized category, but thinking about articulation, the ways in which notions of difference are always discussed in relation to kind of other categories of analysis. Here, thinking again about Tyler's talk yesterday, gender, race, and in my book, questions of space. So this statement, Ibrahim died because he was black. How do we reconcile that statement with this kind of experience, this critique that I often receive, and I've received it since I've been in the business on both sides of the Atlantic. Specifically, I want to situate this historical utterance. And to Ibrahim's friend, it was very much an historical fact within the archive. Particularly, I want to ask a question that I think has been asked many times, but has particular meaning, I think, for this roundtable. And the question is, what responsibility do we have as historians to question and to curate the archives upon which we base our research? How can looking beyond, quote-unquote, traditional archives broaden our understanding about what French people are really saying, really thinking, and really experiencing about notions of difference, notions of race? So for this particular chapter, I really kind of pushed myself. I'm not a trained anthropologist, but I really pushed myself to kind of seek out, activists who very much kind of date their period of activism to Ibrahim's death. I worked with organizations in the neighborhood. I really tried to kind of look at and engage with questions that really weren't kind of part of the major narrative that I was seeing in the state archives. There's much more I can say about this, but I also understand that, you know, for example, you know, what do we say when our sources are dead? And I have particular ideas about this that we can address in the Q&A. But for me, really pushing myself to kind of question the archive and kind of look upon people's personal experiences and their personal archives really helped me to really flesh out the story around Ibrahim's death, and in particular, drawing from kind of thinking of the archive in a much more expanded way, helps me to really situate this statement: Ibrahim died because he was black. And in particular, I think in this context, thinking about the different intersections of class, of gender, of race, really helped to flush out and embed this statement within what was, you know, very much at stake in the 1990s, specifically on the one hand, anxieties about so-called immigrant juvenile delinquency, which was a very kind of common theme in the 1990s. From this statement, I think we can also think about anxieties about class and ideas about kind of unemployment and the ways in which there was like fears about an entire class of people bringing down the French welfare state. There was also embedded in this statement, Ibrahim died, was killed because he was black, notions of questions about gender and masculinity, the kind of fear about male criminality embodied in the quote-unquote immigrant. And finally, I think this statement, Ibrahim died because he was black, also reflects a kind of spatial context, which I think is really important for this moment in France. The ways in which particular neighborhoods, quartiers sensibles, embody and are sites, crystallizations where these many anxieties are manifest. So, I think I'll just end by recounting a conversation I had with a young French scholar. So I've been lucky enough to participate in this kind of transatlantic conversation on les populations noires en France. And at this particular conference at Berkeley, a young French scholar kind of came to me and says, you know what, this is one of the first times I felt that my research has been taken seriously. He says, it's really hard for me to feel validated in the French context because, you know, I deal with questions of race. This particular scholar, I believe his parents might have come from Mali. He was also the first generation in his family to become an academic. And so I want to take this statement that he made, this kind of sense that he felt really validated in being able to engage at this particular conference, as a starting point upon which to ask a couple of questions. And the first one is, you know, what is his statement about the ability of a new generation of aspiring academics to make it, to not be shut out, really say about diversity in the academy? And finally, what does his statement say about the production of knowledge in the academy and also the policing of knowledge and in the archive? Thank you very much.